Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with the latest in the national debate on gun control. Right now, on the Senate floor, Democrats are filibustering in an attempt to call for congressional action on proposed gun legislations. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy launched the surprise filibuster at 11:21 this morning.
I'm at my wit's end. I've had enough of the ongoing slaughter of innocents, and I've had enough of inaction in this body.
Murphy says he won't end the filibuster until he receives assurance that the Senate will take action on legislation on universal background checks and preventing people on the FBI's terrorism watch list from buying firearms. Murphy is, however, yielding briefly to other Democratic senators for questions. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey spoke a little while ago.
The National Rifle Association does not want potential terrorists to be denied purchasing guns in the United States. Now, what kind of crazy position is that for the NRA to take? That potential terrorists should be allowed to buy guns in the United States.
So the filibuster in the Senate continues. On the House side, things are no less contentious. Yesterday, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton tweeted a picture of himself in fatigues and holding a military rifle. He's a Marine veteran who served 4 tours of duty in Iraq. And along with that picture, he tweeted the words, "I know assault rifles. I carried one in Iraq. They have no place on America's streets." Congressman Moulton joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back.
So, Congressman, tell us a little bit more. Do you have a specific proposal in mind when you say that that the type of rifle you know has no place on America's streets?
Absolutely. We should reinstate the assault weapons ban. It's a law that we passed about a decade ago. It was in place for a couple decades ago. It was in place for a decade. And it would have prevented Omar Mateen from buying the gun that he used to slaughter 49 innocent people in Orlando.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, though. What chance is there any chance of that happening? Is there any chance of there even being debate on the assault weapons ban in the House?
Look, it's incredibly frustrating. I mean, there's been more debate on my social media pages than there has been about gun control in the Houses of Congress. But that's got to change. And I'm confident it will change someday. I just don't know how many more innocent Americans have to die before the Republicans wake up to having this debate and doing our job.
Now, Congressman Moulton, there has been a lot of attention in the wake of what happened in Orlando on these particular types of weapons once again in the United States. But on the other hand, as you know, many experts say that the assault weapons ban had a lot of loopholes in it when it was enacted in those 10 years between 1994 and 2004, and that it was pretty ineffective in curbing overall gun violence, even if it may have reduced the incidence temporarily of mass shootings. So why would the Omar Mateen example, which is an important one, but that example aside, why do you think reinstating the ban would be effective when we talk about gun violence overall?
Well, it's a common sense step in the right direction. And certainly the scourge of mass shootings that we see in America today wasn't so bad back when the assault weapons ban was in place because people didn't have access to these weapons of mass murder. There are a lot of things that we need to do to curb this violence. And frankly, we should be willing to have a good, honest debate about exactly what type of assault weapons ban we pass to make sure that there aren't the loopholes in the new law that there were in the previous one. But we've got to take these common sense steps that so many Americans, Republicans and Democrats alike, demand. And yet today in Washington, the Speaker of the House won't even let us have a debate or a vote on the issue.
Now, Congressman Moulton, I'm thinking about that picture that you tweeted yesterday, and I'm wondering, I mean, you have used a military-style assault weapon, a fully automatic one, in the theater of war. Can you tell us what it was like to use that weapon and what made it good for you as a Marine in Iraq that you think doesn't make it good for civilian use?
I mean, look, these weapons are designed to kill people. And, you know, sadly, that's the job of our armed services, and that's why they're important to have overseas. But they have no place here at home. You know, no hunter needs an AR-15 to hunt, unless he has no idea how to hunt, I guess. These are weapons of war. And in the same way that we outlaw other weapons of war, like landmines or anti-tank rockets, because we deem them too unsafe to have here at home, we should outlaw assault rifles as well.
Hmm. Now, just to be clear, of course, you were using, in the military, you were using a fully automatic one, whereas the military-style weapons for civilian use are semi-automatic. I mean, is that a meaningful enough difference for you?
No, absolutely not. In fact, you know, the training in the Marines is that you always shoot on semi-automatic. That's the most effective way to use the weapon and not overuse your ammunition. It's really a silly distinction, and if you really want to get technical about it, I think that arms manufacturers would say that automatic really refers to the type of cycling where you don't have to reload a round into the chamber manually. And so whether it's a semi-automatic or a fully automatic weapon, it's still an automatic weapon, and they have no place on our streets.
Now, finally, Congressman Moulton, if I can just shift gears a tiny bit with you, away from the assault weapons ban question. You also have been critical of the Obama administration's strategy in combating ISIS in the past. You and I have talked about this before, and you've said that the Obama administration doesn't have a long-term strategy, and that made me wonder. I wonder what you made of what the president said yesterday when he gave that quite impassioned speech after speaking with members of his national security advisors, because he said that he's added more U.S. personnel in Syria and Iraq, that the military has launched 13,000 airstrikes and taken out 120 top ISIS leaders, and that ISIS has lost nearly half of the populated territory it once controlled, Iraq. And the president also said the group is losing ground in Syria. And I was wondering if you two thought that was progress or not enough.
No, it's absolutely progress, and I think it's important to be clear about my criticism here. The Obama administration has done a fantastic job of ensuring a military defeat of ISIS. The president is absolutely right. They haven't gained any territory since sometime over a year ago. We are going to defeat them. I've been to the front lines. I was there just a couple months ago as a member of the House Armed Services Committee to see how the troops are doing. We will defeat ISIS on the ground. But what I want to make sure is that after we do defeat ISIS, we don't have a lack of a political solution that would just allow another group like ISIS to come in its place, the same way that ISIS came into Iraq after we defeated Al-Qaeda in Iraq during the surge. So what I'm talking about is the importance of a long-term political solution so that we don't have to keep sending our troops back to the Middle East to clean up the mess. Mm-hmm. But in terms of cleaning up this mess that ISIS has created, our military strategy is actually going quite well.
That's Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents Massachusetts' 6th District. Always good to talk with you, Congressman Moulton. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
While Congressman Moulton mentioned a particular style of weapon available for sale legally in the United States, it's the AR-15. It's a military-style semi-automatic rifle that's made by more than 30 manufacturers and represents 60% of all civilian rifle sales. And that's according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, an industry trade group. Approximately 8 million of these rifles have been sold in the United States, and the vast majority of them are used by law-abiding gun owners. However, as Congressman Moulton pointed out, a few have been used in some of America's deadliest mass shootings, including Aurora, Colorado, San Bernardino, California, and Newtown, Connecticut. Several media outlets are reporting that the Orlando shooter used a handgun and a Sig Sauer MCX semi-automatic rifle. That's a cousin to the AR-15. So these firearms are now under renewed scrutiny by gun control advocates, and they're also receiving vigorous defense from gun rights groups. But we want to take a step back here for a moment and walk through the story of how a weapon designed for the military became one of the country's most popular civilian firearms. Or, as the NRA calls it, America's rifle. For that, we're joined by Jay Wachtel. He was a special agent and supervisor with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms for 23 years. He's now a lecturer at Cal State Fullerton, and he joins us from NPR West in California. Jay Wachtel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on the show and to help us walk through this history. I mean, start us off. When and where did the AR-15 style of rifle first make its appearance in the United States?
That was in the early 60s when it was adopted by the American military. The original design was from by a company known as Armalite, and the design was sold to Colt. And by the early 60s, it was in wide use in the military. When I enlisted in the Army, that was in the mid-60s, the Army was then transitioning from the M14 rifle to the AR-15.
Interesting. So I'm seeing here that the first AR-15s were designed, as you said, in the 1950s by Eugene Stoner, who was a former Marine, and he developed it for military standards and for military service. And the military version was the M16. So you used this weapon, the M16, in Vietnam?
That's correct.
And what is it like to fire? How does it handle as a firearm?
Compared to the M14 rifles that we had before, it's a totally different weapon. The M14s kick like a mule. Every time you discharged the round, it was like it was going to take your shoulder off. But the design of the AR-15 is just simply amazing. There's virtually no recoil, so you can repeatedly, with great accuracy, put rounds on target in a way that you could never try to do with the M14.
Huh. So no recoil. It's also pretty light, and we've been seeing all day long from people who own these weapons that its customizability is something that people really appreciate.
It is. It's a very compact weapon. It's, as you said, it's very light. It's a completely different animal. We had to, when I arrived in Vietnam, they actually had to retrain us, get us to forget about the M14, because the AR-15 or the M16 was a much, much different weapon. And because of that, far more lethal. As well.
And I understand that some of the things that made it revolutionary at the time that it was first developed and then used by the developed and then later used by the military in Vietnam, as you're saying, is that it fires a relatively small caliber bullet, the 223, right? And it's a high velocity bullet as well. So what does that mean for the kind of damage that it does to, you know, the person or object that it's being fired at?
The 223 round is a devastating projectile. Its muzzle velocity is so great that when it enters the body, it creates what's called a temporary wound cavity that's many times the diameter of the projectile. So the damage it does, it doesn't have to strike a direct hit. It can pulverize your organs even with a poorly placed shot.
Hmm. So the military, in terms of the purposes that the United States military would want such a weapon, they got exactly what they wanted. I mean, I understand that members of the military are trained to use these weapons, but you don't have to have the best aim in order to use it to inflict the kind of damage you were talking about.
That's exactly the point. And during our training, I remember that being said, that you don't have to be the best shooter in the world to bring someone down and make sure that they stay down.
Huh. So how is it and when did the AR-15 style of rifle go from being primarily manufactured for the military to being manufactured for civilians, civilian use and sales?
Virtually instantly. Colt realized that they had a very marketable weapon on hand. We're firearms enthusiasts, and partly because of our involvement, you know, in Vietnam and the popularity of the rifle, you know, would be more than happy to, you know, purchase the weapons. So it was in the early 60s when Colt started selling them for civilian use. Now, they were, as you said before, they were the semi-automatic version, but they fired the same cartridge, and their accuracy at range, their cyclic rate, the ability to put rounds on target, and the devastating effect of their projectile was the same.
I'm speaking with Jay Watchtell. He served with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms for 23 years. He's now a lecturer at Cal State Fullerton, and he's joining us from NPR West in Culver City, California. And we're talking about the history of what the NRA calls America's rifle, the AR-15 style of rifle, which is a military-style semi-automatic rifle that represents, as we said a little earlier, some 60% of civilian rifle sales in the United States now. And Mr. Watchtell, when you said that that they were available for civilian use almost instantly, I'm looking at a year here from our research, 1963, so almost at exactly the same time that Colt was making them for the military use.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So what do you think? They're popular in the civilian market. Wasn't instantaneous in the early 60s, in the 60s and 70s, in comparison to how popular they are now. But what makes them so popular for gun owners and gun enthusiasts in America today?
Well, the capability of the firearm is such that it's like, you know, if you're into cars, I used to like classic cars, so you want the quickest, the best looking. Well, with firearms, the AR-15 and the AR-15 type is the slickest. So people who like firearms are going to like the AR-15 because of its appearance, because of its performance particularly, and because it represents a very important part of our military history. So it has a lot of heritage.
Mm. I read an article from Connecticut that quoted a retired detective there who was talking about how the customizability of the weapon is like, he said the AR-15 is like Legos for grown-ups because you can adapt them for different calibers, different barrel stocks with just a few simple tools. Now, from the point of view of law enforcement, I mean, you served with ATF for more than two decades. What are your concerns about the popularity of AR-15 style rifles in the United States?
Well, one hears a lot about the militarization of the police, you know, police running around in armored cars. Well, that's why. It's the AR-15 and firearms like it that fire these extremely high-velocity projectiles inaccurately. They can pierce any commonly worn body armor, so body armor isn't going to do you any good. So that's why we've got police officers running around in armored vehicles. It has, over the last several decades, drastically changed the nature of policing in the U.S.
That's interesting because I'm also seeing, though, that on the other hand, the industry, the gun industry, is selling AR-15 style rifles to law enforcement and to security. There was a 2015 Smith & Wesson annual report that said that in their language, modern sporting rifles are specifically designed to satisfy the functionality and reliability needs of global military law enforcement and security personnel. So, I mean, is the gun industry being able to sell to both sides here?
Well, they're able to. They've been enabled, and these devastating firearms are now in, you know, the hands of, you know, numerous civilians, and it was done obviously for the sake of a buck.
Hmm. Now, this isn't the first style of weapon to be available for civilian use and legal sales that's come from a military background. I mean, a lot of firearms historians would say that's sort of the story of weaponry in the United States, but. Do you think, given what you said about the militarization of the police and the concerns that law enforcement have about these kinds of weapons being on the streets, that an assault weapons ban should once again be enacted? I mean, did it make a difference between 1994 and 2004 when such a ban was in place?
Well, the original assault weapons ban, I was with ATF, you know, when it was enacted. The original assault weapons ban had absolutely no teeth. It did not prohibit such guns. It prohibited the Colt AR-15 and other weapons by name, and it also prohibited any semi-auto weapons that could accept a detachable magazine and had two or more of certain, you know, external features such as a folding stock or pistol grip or a flash suppressor. What happened was that Colt and the other manufacturers, they just simply renamed their firearms and put out equivalent guns, guns that are just as lethal, but didn't have, you know, a folding stock or pistol grip or whatnot. And they just kept on trucking. So the effect of the assault weapons ban in the real world was nil.
Hmm. Well, so then what would you recommend? I mean, I hear your concern about these weapons in the United States today. I mean, what would you recommend be done?
Well, I mean, there's talks about bans. I mean, one option that one could take would be to, say, establish a point system where you take ballistics, rapid fire capability, ammunition capacity, accuracy at range, and other things into account, and some weapons, you know, will make it and some won't. But the consequences of making these highly lethal weapons widely available, they can't be addressed by simply tinkering with laws, okay? I mean, we've lost our moral compass, you know. The original assault weapons ban was, when the law was written, those who wrote the law wrote it specifically so that it could be easily circumvented. So, you know, law reflects really our worst tendencies, you know, to egoism, to self-indulgence. We simply need to get rid of firearms that are these unreasonably lethal. And that would probably extend, you know, further than just simply the AR-15 or AR-15 variants.
Mr. Watchtell, forgive me for saying this, because I know a lot of our listeners right now are shaking their head in vigorous agreement with what you just said. But on the other hand, it also sounds impossible. I mean, it is impossible. There are 8 million of these weapons already in the United States. I mean, that just getting rid of them is never going to happen. So I'm struggling here trying to find if it's not an assault weapons ban, and you know, maybe there's some other other potential laws that we could use. What is there between that and getting rid of the weapons, which just can't happen?
Well, this dilemma was brought on by us ourselves. We brought on this dilemma because of our greed, manufacturers' greed. We also brought it on because of our concern with, you know, individual and corporate rights that overrides any kind of sense, you know, of any kind of a moral compass, or forget the social contract. So what do we do now? Well, we can actually pass an assault weapons ban that has teeth, that doesn't have all the provisions that, you know, would allow manufacturers to simply rename, you know, rebrand their guns and keep on trucking. But beyond that, I think we need a national dialogue. And perhaps the poor folks in Orlando, maybe they can help us begin a national dialogue about what do we do now? What is the next step? They're the ones that would know better than anyone else.
Hmm. Well, can I get your view on one last question here? Because the fact that you spent 23 years at ATF, you know, day in and day out working on this issue and thinking about this, and we're talking about a very specific class of firearms, AR-15 style semi-automatic rifles in the United States. But we were looking at FBI statistics, and the FBI says that in 2014, only 248 rifles of any kind were used in gun murders in the United States, compared with more than 5,500 handguns. So I just wonder what your reaction is to that when thinking overall about gun violence.
the problem of gun violence in the U.S., as you indicate, goes way beyond, you know, mass murders. The essential problem here is it's really not about the law. You know, we keep trying to come up with new laws and new ways of regulating and whatnot. It's not about the law. It's about morality. We really need. I'm not trying to, you know, deflect your question. You mm-hmm. know, but we could be talking about the law, you know, until doomsday. But it's really a problem about morals, about what kind of a country do we want to be. Other countries have dealt with this. For example, Great Britain. And they had, you know, massacres over, you know, in Great Britain. They had a horrible school massacre in the late 90s. And they decided, As a country, they came together and they decided to essentially outlaw semi-automatic weapons that fired beyond the .22 caliber rimfire. Yeah. Do we need to go to that extreme? I don't know, but we need a national discussion about it.
Yeah. Mr. Washtell, my last question. I'm going way over time here, but I can't help it. What did you see in your two decades at ATF that led you to this conclusion that essentially you're calling for a moral reckoning in America about our relationship with guns? What did you see on the job?
You know, I had been on the job for 2 years, and I hate to give up my age, but it was in 1975 when I had only been with ATF for a couple of years. I worked my first big gun trafficking case in Phoenix, where somebody was selling guns at a gun show, handguns, large quantities to all buyers. And we did a case on that person for unlicensed dealing, but that person was obtaining their firearms from a local gun dealer over the counter. That local gun dealer was selling this individual dozens of cheap handguns. And I went and I talked to that gun dealer and I said, what were you thinking? What did you think this man was going to do with them? Well, the answer was, well, I don't know. You know, it was legal to sell. So end of story. That's what we have to deal with.
Well, Jay Watchtell is a retired Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agent. He served at ATF for 23 years. He's currently a Cal State Fullerton lecturer. And he joins us from Culver City, California. Mr. Watchtell, thank you so very much for your perspective and your time today.
Well, you're welcome.
Listeners, let us know what you think about what you heard about semi-automatic rifles in America and about what Jay Watchtell said about calling for a moral reckoning about our relationship with guns. Send us your comments at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.